The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the Slate Plus TV Club for Downton Abbey Season 6. I'm June Thomas, and I'm here with Seth Stevenson for the final countdown. Seth, are you ready to say goodbye?
Shrimpy, We'll never be ready to say goodbye to Downton. We'll break out the Veuve Clicquot. It's been a long road. Mm-hmm. Can we really mark the end, as Lady Mary said of Bates and Anna's subplot? Can we really mark the end? But we must break out the Veuve Clicquot and celebrate the end of something that's brought us all so much joy.
Well, Balmy, I just have to say one thing. To you, it's Lady Shrimpy, okay?
I apologize, Lady Shrimpy. Okay. I didn't mean to demote you. But this is 1925, June.
Are you going to tell me times are changing?
Times are changing.
Whoa, that's new on Downton Abbey. So where shall we begin this week? We're back, and so we had a supersized episode. What was the outstanding theme for you this week?
Well, I think times are changing, as always. As always was the theme. The people living in the Downton Abbey lifestyle are like the dot-commers of 1999, and now it's 2001.
Oh, and I remember those days well.
The sword of Damocles is falling, and everyone realizes the gig is up. The good times are going to stop rolling, and the everything has crashed in this sector, that being the obnoxious lords and ladies sector. Mm-hmm. And everyone needs to get out, and everyone's looking for a safe landing.
Uh-huh.
And so we have the staff, the downstairs staff, all kibitzing with one another, much like the employees in the break room of Pets.com might have in, you know, August of 2000, wondering what's going to become, what's our escape pod, where are we going to go to, what's going to happen. And then, you know, we have upstairs Lord Grantham and Lady Mary talking about how they're going to manage this estate mm-hmm. in the future and, mm-hmm. and whether they need to downsize. And we have the estate next door greatly affecting Daisy's father-in-law, the farmer. I've forgotten his name.
Mr. Mason.
And once again, there we have the estate being bought and the former owners downsizing and auctioning off these noble relics of their past.
Right. The portraits of their grandfathers.
So I'd say that. And then, you know, again, times are also changing for Lady Edith. What will become of her? She has no place in this present moment. Will she just travel? Will she do charity work? Will she sit about Downton Abbey and absorb the snipes of Lady Mary?
Or will she go to London and be in a nice pied-à-terre and boss around people, journalists, and tell them to meet their deadlines?
I know what I do. I want to be in a room where I meet Virginia Woolf.
And Liz Strachey.
Yes. Lady Edith should stop complaining.
She really should.
Well, I would say let's start off, June. Mm-hmm. I guess beyond those broader themes, those tiny changes, I guess the specific story point that was sort of the procedural element of this episode, which was all wrapped up by the end of it, was the blackmail plotline,
yes.
where we had this evil northern lady. Aren't they all like that, June?
Oh,
aren't
my
all
God.
Northerners like
this
that?
This is the thing that drives me crazy about one of the many things. So the evil, I mean, that woman just had horns and a tail and there was sulfur around her. I mean, God, could there have been any more vile? And of course, she had a right good Scouse accent, you know what I mean? Yes, Lady Mary, I know what you were doing in that bedroom. I know. Oh, it was so offensive. And even worse than that, Cora, I'm sure they'd been saving it for the entire run of the show and finally were like, it's almost over, get it done. She said to, someone as they were wandering around the grounds, trouble at mill. And I thought, shut up, bitch. Yes, there's trouble at mill. And your head will be on the tumbril by the end of this season, matey. So just whatevs.
Well, that sounded like a gendered insult to me, first of all. So I hope our listeners won't be offended by that. Second of all, I will say I felt that evil black maelstress that we met, yeah. I mean, I thought just that accent just seemed to suit her. It just, to me, it gave me chills. I felt like I needed to run screaming from that accent.
Quite right. Just in case anyone thought I really had seen Cora's head in a bucket or in a basket by the end, we haven't watched ahead. When Downton isn't on, Seth and I never leave our homes.
We're sequestered.
We're sequestered.
Julian Fellowes issues a sequestration mm-hmm. order to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we go to hotel rooms for the entire off-season.
The Grand Hotel in Liverpool, as it happens.
Yes. And then later we get blackmailed because June and I share a room.
You know.
And so we've not watched ahead. Frankly, I couldn't hold that much information in my mind anyway. I wouldn't be capable of going back and remembering what happened when. So it's all a surprise to us. But yes, the blackmail.
Who are you?
Lisa Bevan. Don't you know me, Lady Mary, because I know you?
No, I do not know you.
And I suppose you've forgotten the Grand Hotel in Liverpool too, my lady. And the night you spent there with Viscount Gillingham. I was a chambermaid. But I suppose we're invisible to people like you.
This is all nonsense. You've no proof.
Don't be silly. You don't know what I've got. To start with, I've got a page from the register.
Then you are a thief.
Yes, I am a thief. And I want £1,000 to keep my mouth shut.
That's ridiculous.
We'll see how ridiculous it is. I'm going now, but I'll be back.
Don't bother. You're not the first person who's tried to blackmail me.
Well, I'm glad you know how it works. And as I say, I will be back.
The stakes for me.
I know the problem with Downton Abbey, the perpetual problem stakes.
Well, first of all, we know the perpetual problem with Downton Abbey is that the stakes storylines happen again and again in just like very slightly altered forms.
I guess this time with a Scouse accent.
Yeah, proving the maxim that history may not repeat, but it does rhyme. But again, once again, Lady Mary, she might bring scandal upon the entire family, and someone is threatening to reveal Lady Mary's scandalous doings, and Lady Mary needs to keep it from her father. Because what will he think of her, and will this bring the family down? And then it's resolved at the end. And it turns out Lord Grantham doesn't think any less of Lady Mary, or he can somehow fit into his worldview of Lady Mary that this fact that she also maybe kind of sluts it up sometimes. That was also a gendered, and I'd like to retract that vote.
Here's the thing. Not only did he not think worse of her, he actually thought better of her. And he decided, based on her behavior with the would-be blackmailer, that she should be the agent of Downton. I mean, it was ridiculous. However, clearly the main problem here was that our Scouse bint should have been blackmailing Tony Gillingham, not yeah. Lady Mary. I mean, that was just moronic. Prima facie.
Fair point, June. It's true that Lord Grantham essentially said, well, Mary, given that you strung along poor Lord Gillingham by sleeping with him, having no intention of bringing the relationship any further along, and given that you nearly brought ruin upon this family, I feel that you deserve a promotion.
Exactly. If only it worked that way in life, Seth, we could be really successful. Poor bloody Anna, the martyr of our parish, was forced to listen to Lady Mary's brought upon herself, sort of. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having sex with Tony Gillingham in Liverpool. What else are you going to do in Liverpool?
Who hasn't?
Right. But Lady Mary has Anna doing her bidding. It's her job, I know, but oh, God. It just, on top of everything else that she has to deal with all Lady Mary's problems, it's an agitation to me. She was looking awfully drawn, was dear Anna.
I mean, and what a thankless, what a thankless just entire being.
Exactly. She gets to do Lady Mary's bidding. Then she has to go home with Bates.
And it's just pure misery. Just every time they're together, it's like, oh, no, we're under it again. Mm. Oh, but we're going to fight through it. No couple has seen worse than us. And June, you and I have been on record for at least a couple of seasons now that we are sick of the Bates and Anna storyline. We would not be unhappy if some sort of 1920s alien presence came down and abducted Bates and Anna. They were never heard from again.
Never.
In fact, we were rooting for Bates to be hung, I believe.
Yeah.
We wanted
all hanged.
Hanged. So you're the former copy editor.
That's right.
Thank you for stepping in there. Uh-huh. We were rooting for Bates to be hanged because we hated that storyline. So I'm sure he's a good man. He's fine. No one deserves to be hanged if he's innocent.
Right.
And yet, we wanted him to swing from the gallows just to get that storyline off our television sets.
We almost crowdfunded it. We almost crowdfunded, build a time machine so that we could go back in time and make the evidence more obvious for Bates to be hanged.
If we would like to frame Bates.
Yeah, we would have framed Bates to get rid of him. And now the sword of Damocles is over Downton. The shadow of the noose is no longer over the Bateses.
And thank goodness for that.
Yeah,
I'm
sick of that.
I personally popped a bottle of Clicquot,
right?
Of my own to drink along with the Downtoners to celebrate the end of that storyline. I don't quite believe that it's over. Something tells me that there will be more woe in store for Bates and Anna as the season goes on. But I was so thrilled. I turned on my gramophone. I popped a bottle of Verve. Yeah. I dropped the needle on Thanks a Million. What was the song you
right.
love? Thanks a Million.
Boops a Million.
Boops a Million.
Yeah.
Whatever it was.
Yeah.
Shrimpy's a Million. And I partied along with them because thank goodness that storyline is done with. And I hope that they'll have some sort of like fun, sprightly, romantic adventures together now, more in the mold of Hughes and Carson, which is a delightful storyline.
Shall we go there?
Yes. Let's put in our rearview mirror the Bates and Anna marriage and let us talk about this nation. Marriage, this burgeoning love.
Oh my goodness.
That it's so beautiful to behold.
Indeed. And Carson's so proud of his love, so proud of his wife.
That man has such dignity, Jim.
Oh my goodness.
Such dignity. Just implacable in his quest for dignity. And I love him for it. And, you know, we saw, June and I can reveal that we went to a Downton event, a PBS Downton event. Mm-hmm. We took pictures with cardboard cutouts of the Dowager Countess and Thomas.
I thought they were a little two-dimensional, but the characters always have been.
Those were no June. These were, in fact, cardboard cutouts. That was not Thomas.
Oh, wow.
To see dimensional Thomas' character. That was. And we saw Carson and Hughes. I'm forgetting the actors' names.
Jim Carter and Phyllis Logan.
Thank you. Sitting together on stage.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say that the fellow who plays Carson, he was every bit as delightful in real life as he is on screen.
Yeah.
He's got a true charm about him. You just want to be around that man. I just wanted like a teddy bear hug from him.
Yeah, and you could see that just as he did a little bit, he went and got some wine and poured it for the toffs. He had the foresight and the speed of mind to go and do that. Similarly, he will always take the step to save Downton. He can't stop Lady Mary from riding astride, but he can save civilization from falling around them. And he can reveal to the go-between that Mrs. Hughes put poor Mrs. Patmore, who Leslie Nichol, who plays Mrs. Patmore, was magnificent, can we agree, in that role?
Oh, in those scenes, so great, and her discomfort was palpable, her disquietude at having to bring these matters up with Carson.
Yeah.
So delightful. And good on Carson for he wants every bit a marriage. He wants every bit of Mrs. Hughes.
He does. June. He doesn't want a fake patter cake.
I was going to look that up. Patter cake?
Patter cake, I guess. Maybe like playing childhood games, you know, when you you do hand jobs. But I mean, I think.
June.
No, what's that? Like hand driving, I think. Whatever.
Patty cake.
Yeah, patty cake. Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
Children's games.
I guess it meant platonic, but he a brother sister type relationship. He didn't want that. He wanted to ravish Mrs. Hughes.
And I think Mrs. Hughes, her concern, her nervousness, her wariness about ravishment was whether he would indeed find her attractive, knowing that she's no longer in the bloom of youth. But he made it clear that he finds her beautiful. He wants to have at it.
Yes, he does.
And I'm sure she wants to be have had at.
Yeah, and I bet he calls her Elsie in bed.
I bet.
And as Mrs. Padmore pointed out quite fairly to Mrs. Hughes, I mean, it's not like Mr. Carson has been hitting the weight bench either, you know? it's not like he's been self-tanning and doing his elliptical training. So, I think they're going to be a well-matched pair and will find great passion through their respect for each other.
Right. And I from evermore... whenever I need to have a difficult conversation, perhaps with you, Seth, I'm going to just turn away ever so slightly. We can't do it here because we'll go off mic and that would be a disaster.
Would you like a glass of port, June?
I won't. Oh, well, perhaps I will.
You sound like a governess in fear of dismissal. That was my favorite Dowager Countess insult of the week.
Oh, really? I was more fond of does it ever get cold on the moral high ground, which I think came from Cousin Isabel, who I guess isn't yet married to Lord Merlin. But they're already at the stage where they're making whispered asides to one another.
They're like an old married couple.
Indeed.
And what does she say? Let's not make too much of it.
That was so good.
I'm glad we agree on this. Don't let's make too much of it.
For all of our cavils and carping about the show, there are some really magnificent actors involved.
Oh, the performances are incredible. I mean, I think that's why people keep coming back. Yeah. Just these people. I mean, the characters, sometimes they can be a bit rote and the storylines can be a bit predictable and repetitive. But yes, the performances within that world, the way mm-hmm. that people bring life to these characters is amazing. And, all, you know, across the board, all yeah. of them, so yeah. well chosen.
Yeah. So we saw Cousin Isabel and Lord Merlin at the big fight of the year. This is, to me, the low point in terms of, like, the creativity. The big York hospital wants to take over the local Downton hospital. And this has the Dowager Countess and Cousin Isabel at daggers drawn. And you think, could it have possibly been something we could care about?
Wait, what do you mean, June? I'm really looking forward to learning the ins and outs, the bureaucracy, the administrative procedures of
how many beds
of local versus regional hospital control in 1925 Britain. This is a fascinating area.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking I'm going to get a few books out of the library on the topic, really bone up so I can appreciate the nuances of the show. I completely disagree.
Yeah. Regional MacGuffin reorganization was very, very big in 1925.
Well, whatever gets the Dowager Countess and Cousin Isabel in a room together firing off sparks, I am all for whatever form that takes.
So it looks like Cora actually also is going to get in the middle of that. She might finally stand up to the Dowager Countess.
She's no match for the Dowager Countess.
Nah, true.
She's no match. She will wilt under that pressure, as will Danker. And Spratt, which was our other sort of face-off in this episode. Danker and Spratt make I sort of misremembered what happened toward the end of it. But I was like, last we saw her, she was like getting drunk and leading young men into temptation and
right.
gambling houses. And
right.
how did she maintain her position after all that? But I guess she did. I guess I'm not quite remembering how that all went down. But there she is still. And she's learned nothing.
Nothing.
She's learned nothing. She's still a horrid person. It's going to spread anxiety throughout the bowels of Downton Abbey, making Spratt's life a
yeah.
nightmare, threatening him.
If this was that .com office in 2000, she would have been the person who accidentally on purpose left something on the photocopier about planned layoffs. I don't know. She gets excited. She thinks she knows something that other people don't know. And then she forgot what she was dealing with. And as soon as the Dowager C realized what she was doing, she was right back on her.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's sort of like Danker. You know, Danker was saying, "Oh, well, ladies will always need people to dress them and undress them," which is another one of those 2015. Ha ha!
Uh-huh.
Don't we know better now that in fact ladies can dress and undress themselves? But it was sort of like, you know, a .com or being like, "Well, Silicon Valley will always require graphic designers. They won't need PR people, so you're doomed." And then right. it didn't matter. Everybody got laid off. But Spratt. The delightful Spratt. You know, sort of an echo of Carson in his demand to maintain dignity at all times and his resentment of anyone who would dare to undermine his dignity. Sort of like Carson, and yet he's a bizarro Carson and that he's much less likable.
He's like Carson if with like one quarter Moseley. just a sort of like he rubbed shoulders with Moseley once too often, so a little bit of the Moseley rubbed off on him. And
if Carson and Moseley were to consummate their relationship in the way and could somehow impregnate one another in the way that Carson and Hughes will be consummating their relationship.
They'll be impregnating one another.
probably not also. Yeah. So, yes. But that is you make a fair point. He does have a little bit of Moseley in him, but none of the I would say none of the good heart of Moseley. Like, Moseley has a good heart to redeem him, right? Moseley sort of, there's this nice idealism about Moseley. Moseley, like, wants to see the best in people, and he wants to be helpful. He wants a better world and to be a part of that better world. There's something a little bit beautiful about
exactly.
and tragic
there
about Moseley. Whereas Spratt, I think, just wants to go along and get along and
right.
curry favor from the Dowager Countess.
Right. And at least Denker, by the end of the episode, is being a little bit brought down. So that's all we can hope for.
I'd like to see Danker put in her place.
Exactly. So I guess the final big topic of this episode is the neighboring estate, it appears. The owners have to sell up. They can't keep it going. And so the whole Downton family, the whole Crawley family, goes over to the sale just to kind of, in part to be in solidarity, in part they want to maybe just pick up a little souvenir because Papa used to be close with that family. And also Daisy goes because Mr. Mason has been given an order to quit because the family needs vacant possession for the new owners. And Daisy, as is so often the case, since she's now had a bit of boot learning, she goes off a bit, doesn't she?
She cracks out of turn.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not her place. And all of the Crawleys, the Crawley family is warning her not to do this. This is not her place to do this. But she says, no, Lord Grantham, I am going to, you know, she feels so strongly about it. And her principle is correct.
Yeah.
She is correct. And but the dynamics are such that she just simply cannot have the soliloquy without there being some sort of repercussion. But the sad thing is, we know the repercussion for her is like a minor punishment from Carson and Hughes. She will not lose her job. But the repercussion for Mr. Mason could be, you know, that even though they will keep on some tenants, that he will be singled out for having his lease terminated. Is that I don't know if that's what would say that. He was going to be kicked off simply because Daisy has now brought him into disfavor with the new ownership.
Yeah. And I have to say the Hendersons do seem that Mr. Henderson seems a bit of a shit, I would say. I think that's the technical term for the kind of man that he is. Foolish, probably, also, to take on a big estate like that. I don't know, you know, if that old family couldn't make a go of it. I don't know why he thinks he could. Probably won't. But I guess we shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth if you're that family. But yeah, Mr. Mason seems to be a little bit doomed. It's funny because we heard in the show as the, you know, the Downton household is shrinking. The underfoot ladies or whatever they are resigning. The housemaids are resigning. One wants to work in a shop because her young man wants to see her in a way that isn't possible. You know, it's like being in a nunnery when you work in a big house like that. And so the staff, the servants, could potentially get jobs. But Mr. Mason, being a more senior gentleman, it's not so clear, like, what his path is. This is before the days of pensions and so on. And
right. I was going to say he needs Social Security.
Yeah, he really is going to be thrown on the ash heap.
Well, something tells me that the good people of Downton might swoop in and save the day at some point, and that Lord Grantham might get yet another opportunity to seem lordly and gracious and, oh, what a fine man is he, because he's going to provide some sort of tenant situation for Mr. Mason on the Downton grounds.
Although in a sense, I know this is probably going too far, but the fact that Daisy really has lost her sense of her place. I mean, yes, it's the way of the world. It's the way that things are changing. But she was allowed to ride in the front seat. She was talking with the family, with the Viscount, as if he was her buddy, refusing his advice. In a way, you could say that the way that the Crawleys have treated their servants as friends is what caused the problem that Mr. Mason is now going to be the sufferer of, possibly, probably.
That, oh, I like that. I like the way you brought anything that comes back around on Lord Grantham. It's his fault.
It is. That Scousebit said that.
Well, June, I'm so excited to be back here discussing Downton with you.
Ditto.
Although every time I hear you speak, I think I'm about to be blackmailed. and I look forward to discussing each new episode with you. Together, we shall walk down the road. Can we really be marking the end of this long road? But we shall together, and with you, our listeners, we shall. And at the very end, we shall all put on the gramophone and pop some Veuve Clicquot
and ride a stride.
But until then, we'll have so much to talk about.
Until episode 2, Sethi.
Until then, Shrimpy.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.